Welcome to Talking History. My name is Carl Bontempo, and I'm a professor at the University at Albany in the History Department. Our guest today is Mary Dudziak, who is a historian and lawyer from the University of Southern California, and we are delighted that she is here with us. She is the author of a brand new book called Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey, published by Oxford University Press. She is the author of another very important book, one that I teach in my class, called Cold War Civil Rights, which is a fantastic book. And so today we are delighted to have Mary with us to talk about history, the Cold War, civil rights, and maybe even some contemporary politics, if she's willing to answer those questions. Mary, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
And we are happy you are here as well. Well, I'd love to talk a little bit about what brought you to the Thurgood Marshall book. Your previous book, Cold War Civil Rights, explored the American civil rights movement through an international lens. And it made me wonder, how did you decide to write on Marshall and his African experience?
Well, when I was writing Cold War Civil Rights, I was so interested in the way arguments about American law and the Constitution were made in an international context for reasons that had nothing to do with law enforcement. It was part of American public diplomacy. So, for example, in the context of the Little Rock crisis in 1957-58, the State Department sent speakers around the world to talk about federalism. And so basically, ideas and arguments about the American law were part of American public diplomacy. And I was really interested in that. And I got interested in looking at how American law travels around the world in contexts like that, where it's part of the politics and diplomacy of international affairs. So I was originally going to do a big book that looked at lots of different people in lots of different countries, for example, rethinking the story of why on earth General MacArthur puts gender equality in the Japanese Constitution. I think there's more to say about that. But I finally figured out, you know, two things. One is I came across the Thurgood Marshall story, and that was so fabulous, I thought. But the second thing is that the bigger book, looking at lots of stories involving different people, different moments in time, different countries, was just not going to be a very it was going to take me the rest of my life to do the archival research and figure all of those different narratives out. So once I started looking at Thurgood Marshall and I figured out that there was a story to tell, that basically took over and that became the book.
Were you familiar with the Marshall story before you started the research? Because it's not a story that I was familiar with, and I think many of my colleagues have expressed surprise to me as well that they had not heard of this.
I was not familiar with it. Now, it's briefly mentioned in the major biographies of Thurgood Marshall, but it's really treated as if he went on some vacation. You know, it's treated as this little, you know, passing moment, as if you went to the Bahamas for a weekend. So it wasn't something that was really anything I was familiar with.
That leads me to think a little more. I'd love to hear some more about Marshall, because one of the things that stands out to me in the book, it's one of the joys of the book, are the stories and the anecdotes about Marshall. And you do this wonderful job of painting a picture of him as a person, as a real person, rather than just as a civil rights and legal legend that I know him as, and I'm sure many of our listeners do. Could you tell us a little bit more about Marshall's personality, what kind of man he was, what his daily life was like?
Well, you know, when I was writing the book, I became increasingly aware from talking with people about Marshall that this generation, learning about civil rights history now, a lot of folks really have no sense of Marshall at all. People who know anything about him tend to think about him in two different contexts. One is Marshall as a civil rights lawyer, and then Marshall, you know, aging Supreme Court justice. And for many Americans, the only thing they know about him, if they know anything, is this sort of older man at the moment of his retirement from the Supreme Court in the 1990s.
Right.
So one of the things I felt was needed was just, in some ways, an introduction of this man, you know, to a readership. And so the book is very much a 1960s snapshot in time of Thurgood Marshall. It's about his work in Africa, but set in the context of his public life in the United States during that time. And so one of the first things I do in the book, in the first chapter, is I take the reader on a trip with Marshall, just as a way of the reader sort of getting to know him. And what you see, I think, on this trip to a civil rights meeting is this man who, you know, his friends would stress how full of life he was, what a sort of outsized personality he was, how much fun he was. And this came through for me, especially in an oral history interview I did with a man who was a young lawyer, staff director of the Civil Rights Commission, Burl Bernhard, who traveled to Kenya with Marshall in 1963 on a return trip. And he stressed how much the Kenyans that Marshall worked with loved him. And so one of the things that's interesting about him is the way that the force of his personality brought people in and allowed him to form relationships that were part of the effectiveness of his work. Because Marshall, even when he was a civil rights lawyer, he wasn't just doing litigation, going into court, making arguments, filing briefs, trying to be effective in that context, although that was a lot of his work. He was also fundraising. He was also traveling to southern communities to meet with the local NAACP chapters to, you know, talk with them about their problems, what they wanted the lawyers to do, and to basically enlist their engagement with the legal campaign. And so that that aspect of his personality, you know, being able to communicate so effectively, bring people in, to the charismatic, not in the way we think of someone like Martin Luther King as this sort of broad charismatic speaker, but in some ways on a smaller scale, his people skills were one of the things that made him so effective.
Well, let's talk a little bit. I'd love to talk a little bit about Marshall in Africa and in Kenya in the 1960s. In the book, you tell the story in one of the chapters about Marshall's contribution, writing a Kenyan Bill of Rights. Could you describe the challenges that he faced in writing this part of what would become the Kenyan legal structure?
Yeah. When the nationalists, in 1960, the nationalists in Kenya were going to be meeting at a big constitutional conference with the British government and with other interest groups in Kenya, and it was the first time that the Africans were at the table for this kind of negotiation.
Right.
It was part of the path towards independence, and the nationalists wanted an outside advisor. Who were they going to get as an advisor within the colonial or British system? You know, someone who was, you know, they didn't want a British lawyer. They didn't
Right.
want someone who was out of the colonial system. They wanted someone outside of it. And so that's why they started looking around what American constitutional scholar, you know, who from the United States would be helpful. And through a series of contacts, Marshall ended up being invited to go. Now, the British at this point were really skeptical, and they thought, you know, who is this guy, and does he have any experience with Commonwealth constitutions? And the answer is no. he didn't know anything about it. He asked his staff to help him pull some things together. Jim Neighbrit, Jim Neighbrit III, young lawyer, had just started at the Legal Defense Fund in 1960 when Marshall was embarking on this. And he hands Marshall a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, Marshall, of course, was familiar with international human rights. But one of the things that became very interesting is when he sits down to write what in some ways is his ideal expression of what rights might look like if you're starting from scratch. And he turns to some of the immediate post-colonial constitutions that he clearly got exposed to during his work, the Constitution of Nigeria, the Constitution of what was then Malaya. But most of the Bill of Rights draws from word for word, comma for comma, from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So one of the things that's interesting is he apparently said to Juan Williams in an interview, "When I did my work in Kenya, I looked around at all these constitutions of the world and I decided that the American Constitution was the best one, and that's what I took to Kenya." Well, you know, in some ways what he took that was American was his sensibility as an American lawyer and a set of assumptions about how law works, which in part included the way the courts function as a law enforcer. But the actual text that he drew upon wasn't language straight out of the U.S. Constitution. He drew upon these other post-colonial constitutions, and he drew upon international human rights.
When you say that he was influenced by international human rights, what types of things, principles from the Universal Declaration did he bring to the Kenyan Declaration?
Now, I should say these aspects of the Bill of Rights didn't stay in the final Kenya Constitution.
Of course.
Parts of what he wrote did, but a lot of what he wrote didn't. And these parts didn't. But he builds into his draft Bill of Rights for Kenya what we call social welfare rights. The U.S. Constitution primarily has negative rights. The government can't violate your free speech rights. There should be no bill of attainder clause. Passing a law that says no Carls, you know, can go to school here, for example, that would be a bill of attainder. So, if it was directed at you personally.
Right.
The Universal Declaration had, which Marshall incorporated, had social welfare rights like a right to education. A right to what we would now call a living wage. So there was a right to work clause that included a right to enough income so that you wouldn't be in poverty. So these kinds of positive rights requiring the government to essentially take care of you. This was unknown in the American, still is unknown in the American constitutional experience, but Marshall was thinking about poverty. He was thinking about how that plays out in terms of health, in terms of education. And so he builds those kinds of rights into his ideal draft Bill of Rights for Kenya.
You mentioned that Marshall's best laid plans, including this Bill of Rights, did not all find its way into, I guess, the Kenyan legal structure and Kenyan politics. And I think he discovers this upon his return in 1963, if I'm remembering correctly. Could you tell us what he finds when he goes back and back to Kenya? And how does he react to this discovery?
Yeah. Let me say a little bit about minority rights in 1960 and then how it plays out in 1963. You know, in some ways, ironically, the minority rights issue in the Kenya constitutional debates in 1960, when Marshall is the only person who's not British, not from Kenya, participating in this big conference on the Kenya Constitution in London in 1960. You know, at that moment, the British had signed on to the idea that Africans would end up having majority voting power, one person, one vote. And so the whites said, "Look, you want us to stay on board? We need a Bill of Rights and we need judicial review." And at this point, the whites were basically sending terrorist threats to the colonial government saying, you know, if you give Africans voting power in Kenya, we will blow up everything in Kenya. And so it was this very charged atmosphere. And the objective at that meeting was, how do we keep people on board? And one way to keep people on board was to the African nationalists attempted to, wanted to convince, including the whites in Kenya, you know, that they were going to protect minority rights the rights of whites once they were in power. And so essentially there were two ways to do that. One was they said, look who our advisor is. We have as an advisor the leading constitutional expert on minority rights in the world, so don't worry about it. But also really on the table was property rights for white people, rights that had been had been gained through tremendous injustice, you know, moving Africans off land and then whites claiming it and not allowing Africans to own it or farm it. So part of the negotiations in 1960 was building in property rights clauses that would protect the rights of these entrenched rights in spite of the fact that they were a product of an historic injustice. So that was this bargain that was struck in 1960. So then fast forward, 1963. Marshall goes back, and it's right after the violence against civil rights demonstrators in Birmingham, Alabama, in the United States. The U.S. is tremendously concerned about the impact of the brutalization of civil rights demonstrators on the U.S. image around the world, sends speakers overseas to try to put it, quote, in context, including Chief Justice Earl Warren was sent to Africa, and so was Thurgood Marshall. And Marshall thought, well, he wanted to see how his Bill of Rights was working. And remember, he was especially concerned about minority rights and issues of equality. And his Bill of Rights was framed, the preamble was all about equality. So he gets to Kenya. He's so happy to see everyone. They're thrilled to see him. And then as Burl Bernhardt, his traveling companion, and he are driving around the streets of Nairobi, they see signs that made it look as if the Asian minority was under pressure, that the Asian minority was threatened with eviction from businesses, and some Asians were concerned about being thrown out of the country. Asians were a large minority group in Kenya, more numerous than whites, and they were essentially in the middle of this tiered racial structure under colonial Kenya. So Asians held often civil service positions. They were small business owners. And now they're getting squeezed as the colony is moving towards independence. They don't have the same kinds of entrenched rights, partly because Britain is just not protecting them in the way that they're protecting white British citizens. The possibility of going to India or Pakistan isn't attractive because of economic conditions there. So what's going to happen to the Asians? And they wanted to stay in Kenya, operate their businesses, you know, be part of this new political system, but some were running into discrimination.
In telling us about 1963, you mentioned that Marshall had just come back from the United States and the civil rights, the violence in Birmingham. And I'm wondering, throughout the book, you tell these wonderful, set up these stories in which Marshall is traveling back and forth between the United States, where obviously the civil rights revolution is in full swing, to Kenya, where a different sort of revolution, one might argue, is in full swing. And I'm wondering how he saw these two momentous periods in history, and how he saw these two events happening at the same time. Did one influence the other in his thinking? How did he see them related? Did he see them as related?
Well, I think we can see parallel themes coming through for Marshall in his journey across continents. And one time when he does sort of draw them together in comparison in an oral history interview and talking about his work in 1960 on the Kenya Constitution, he says, you know, that's really working for democracy. When you can do for the white man in Kenya what you can't do for the black man in Mississippi, you know, that's working for democracy. That's good. You know, what's that about? You know, clearly he's, when he goes to work on the Kenya Constitution, here he has won his life's great victory, Brown versus the Board of Education. The case is not being enforced. There's terrible disenfranchisement in states like Mississippi. There's just tremendous, there's lynchings, there's racial violence. And meanwhile, in the years after Brown, the lawyers trying to work in Mississippi, Alabama, and other parts of the Deep South are being harassed. Anti-communist boards, you know, sicked on them, and as well as, you know, statutes that are using codes of professional responsibility to sort of go after the lawyers. So it's really a difficult time. Constance Baker Motley, his colleague at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, described him, says it was like trying to navigate a ship in a hurricane. So it's this difficult time for Marshall, a frustrated time when he's not able to see his handiwork being effectuated in his own country. So then he goes to Kenya, and his law clerks would stress to me that, you know, he saw himself as a framer. You know, this was a moment when, you know, think about the American framing. You know, all of the paintings we have of, you know, these white men sitting around and deciding what rights, what governmental structure should be, and then when the Bill of Rights comes along, what rights should be. But in Marshall's experience working with the nationalists, here are African men and him, an African American, playing a role, being part of the debates, you know, at this moment of framing a nation. Then there's this terrible irony, you know, that working with the nationalists, one of their goals is to protect the rights of, you know, a despised minority, a minority that had come into their land through brutal injustices, but nevertheless was going to be part of a political system moving forward. And this is, you know, a way of sort of keeping everyone in the polity, essentially. And so I think in that comment of Marshall's, you know, doing for the white man in Africa which you can't do for the black man in Mississippi, you know, this irony that in his own country, supposedly the world's leading democracy, that still there were no meaningful voting rights in Mississippi, there were no meaningful minority rights in Mississippi. It was not yet in place. So I think at that moment we see this frustration at the failure of legal change in his own country.
This actually, I think, hits on a part of the book that I found really fascinating, which is how Marshall views the relationship between law and social change. And obviously that's at the heart, at some levels, of the civil rights movement in the United States. And clearly it's also at the heart of the independence movement in Kenya. And I was wondering if he saw that relationship between law and social change as some sort of, perhaps we might say, universal truth. That's my term, not his. Universal truth. Or was it something that might be different in Kenya than in the United States?
Well, I would say that one of the things that comes through for me in these two stories, the Kenya and the U.S. story, is his belief in law, the importance of law as part of social change efforts. I mean, we know that about Marshall on some level, but we really get the texture of it, I think, from both of these stories in the 1960s. But I think that he approached it not as an abstract sort of universal principle, but instead as something that came out of the American experience. Maybe he then abstracts it. But you know where he learned this from? You know, in some ways, he learned it from John Hope Franklin. John Hope Franklin worked with Thurgood Marshall before Brown as an expert witness in school desegregation cases, and then played an important role when they called in a bunch of historians to help with a brief on the question of whether the framers of the Reconstruction Amendments, 13th and 14th Amendments, had what they thought about school segregation. But through their relationship, John Hope Franklin, you know, gives Marshall materials about the history of slavery. And Marshall turns to that kind of material and relies on it sometimes when he's facing, for example, the Bakke case, which affirmative action case, where the court treats government policies that impact whites as the same as government policies that impact minorities who had been historically discriminated against. And Marshall is concerned about this parallel. So Marshall turns to history. And one of the things he says in a 1966 speech to a president's conference on civil rights, and he makes this statement again different times, including in a bicentennial of the Constitution speech. He says, "What is striking to me is the importance of law in determining the condition of the Negro. He was effectively enslaved not by brute force, but by a law which declares him a chattel of his master. He was emancipated by law and then disenfranchised and segregated by law. And finally," Marshall says in 1966, "he is winning equality by law." So basically, he thought that the lessons of history, which again he'd learned in part from John Hope Franklin, were that law had set the conditions of, it was part of the structure of the inequality of African Americans. It was part of their enslavement. It wasn't all of it, but it was a central part of the structure of slavery. It was part of the path towards emancipation. It was part of the structures of disenfranchisement and discrimination through law. And so in order to achieve equality, one of the things you had to do was to change the legal structures that had disenfranchised and discriminated against African Americans. So we just saw it as a part of the African American experience, and one of the things that had to be affected, had to be dealt with, if full equality was going to come about.
And this leads to another historical issue that I know historians have dealt with, which is, what is Marshall's relationship to the other components of the civil rights movement who might not have been working in the legal system to effect change, but in protesting on the streets and things like that? How did Marshall view those folks who were contributing in their own way to a civil rights, what they hoped, revolution?
Right. I think that the story of Marshall's relationship with the civil rights movement has been told in sometimes a one-dimensional way when it's a more complicated story.
Right.
Now, Marshall was in his 50s during the 1960s, right? He's a middle-aged guy. He spent all of his life litigating. He also spent his early career litigating in Southern courtrooms at a time when basically a lot of people wanted him dead.
Right.
And it wasn't very safe for him to do the things he did. He put himself at risk to go into Southern courtrooms in small communities and represent an African-American defendant, for example. So he had the experience of going into a charged and violent atmosphere, being able to do something by going into a courtroom and making legal arguments. So it was his own experience that he could work on some things, not everything, but some things, by going into court and making a legal argument. And he was threatened, but he didn't get killed. So during the early 60s, his son told me he used to talk about the student activists as those beautiful young people, and he would ask about, you know, those beautiful, whatever happened to, you know, these beautiful young people, young demonstrators that he had gotten to know, because he was representing them or had found lawyers to represent them. And John Lewis says in his autobiography that this strikes me as a helpful way of thinking about his relationship, that Marshall it's not that he was opposed to what the students were doing. He just thought that there was another way. Lewis says he just thought we didn't need to be sitting there getting cigarettes put out in our hair, you know, and stuff poured on us, you know, and getting beaten up. He just thought that there was another way and that we didn't need to subject ourselves to violence. So, you know, part of it was just different sensibilities and different ideas about what the situation needed. But another thing that happens is Marshall is in London for the Lancaster House Conference on the Kenya Constitution in early February 1960 when the sit-ins began in Greensboro. He then finishes up his work on the Kenya Constitution, rushes back home, and immediately calls together a conference of civil rights lawyers. What for? To ask the question, how on earth are we going to represent these kids? I mean, that's the way he thought of them as these kids. So, you know, what are we going to do to represent these students? The problem from a lawyer's perspective is the students were arrested for violating laws that on their face were not unconstitutional. Laws like disturbing the peace, laws like vagrancy or trespass. And so you couldn't go into court and say this statute under which these thousands of students have been arrested is unconstitutional, you know, as you could with a school segregation law. So what's your legal argument? That was the problem. One of the problems that the lawyers had is what's the legal argument that we use how can we effectively represent them? So he calls together a legal conference, you know, right after he comes back from London, calls together another later, and they come up with strategies for arguing that when the police arrest someone at the behest of a store owner because the store owner is trying to maintain segregation, that somehow, I mean, one of the arguments that they're working on is somehow that's putting the state, what you would call state action, into the process of enforcing segregation. So you have to attach the state to the discrimination to help make it a 14th Amendment argument, for example. So that kind of argument and others are coming up with creative legal arguments. Meanwhile, what Marshall does is he then spends almost all of his time from, you know, after the sit-ins until he leaves the LDF in 1961 for a federal court appointment. What he's doing is fundraising. He was fundraising because they needed to hire so many lawyers to represent these thousands and thousands of students. So what you see is, you know, did Marshall think that the way forward with social change should be through sit-ins? No, he didn't think so. You know, he wished they weren't doing it, you know, partly because how do we represent them, partly because he was worried they were going to get killed, partly because he thought the courts were a way that was effective. And, you know, on some level, he was wrong about that. You know, you needed to have a broad-based movement in order to put the kind of political pressure on the federal government to get the federal government going somewhere, so that a legal change strategy is going to be more effective when you've also got a broad mass movement. But what he did do is he didn't run around trying to get the students to stop doing what they were doing. Instead, what he did was devoted his time to trying to figure out how to pay the lawyers to represent them and how to get people on board to represent them and how to represent them effectively by developing new legal strategies.
It's fascinating. It really paints a different picture of Marshall than what we've read previously and what I knew about him. Let's take a short break. You've been listening to Talking History with historian Mary Dudziak, the author of Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey.